The human brain, a 3-pound mass of gray and white matter, is the most delicate, complicated organ in the body. It's also one of the most mysterious. It's still unclear how 100 billion nerve cells turn chemical and electrical impulses into thought and emotion. Neurosurgeon Keith Black discusses what we know about the inner workings of the brain and the latest developments in the fight against brain cancer in his book, Brain Surgeon, A Doctor's Inspiring Encounters with Mortality and Miracles, it's written with the help of Aaron Mann and published by Grand Central Publishing, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dr. Black to the show today. Hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Why do you refer to the brain as tiger country?
In terms of neurosurgery, the brain is sacred territory, and we only have a very, very narrow corridor in which to enter the brain and try to treat disorders that affect the human brain. You know, the way that I describe a good brain surgeon is a surgeon that is very much like a thief in the night. What you want to do is that you want to sneak into the brain and sneak out with whatever the abnormality is without the brain ever realizing that you've been there.
And you say your goal is to avoid touching the brain itself. So how do you operate on something without touching it?
Well, one of the things that we try to do is to avoid touching normal brain tissue, but when we go in to remove an abnormality in the brain, such as a tumor, we only want to touch the tumor and basically tease it away without manipulating the normal structures within the brain.
Will just lightly touching or brushing a nerve automatically cause damage?
Not necessarily. The brain is organized in what we call a topographical fashion. So there's some areas that are very critical, areas that are responsible for language, vision, motor movement, some critical areas within the brainstem that are critical for consciousness. Those areas are extremely critical. And in manipulating those areas, we have to be extremely careful not to retract or move those areas in a way that can cause harm.
Some of the nerves are really very, very fragile. Anybody who is worried about glaucoma knows about just how easy it is for an optic nerve to break.
Right. And one of the complexities and difficulties we face in neurosurgery, for example, in the book, we try to take those very complex concepts and make them very simplistic for the reader. But when you have a tumor that has stretched the nerve, made it very thin, it's even more delicate.
In medical school, you practice on cadavers. What was it like to operate on a living person for the first time, knowing that you couldn't do all sorts of things? If your hand shook, right, you were going to cause major problems.
Right. I think, fortunately, you know, I had a lot of experience in doing microsurgery on rats before actually graduating, you know, to patients. But I recall, Leonard, the first time that I removed a brain tumor, and it was when I was a second-year resident. I wasn't expecting to actually, you know, be the primary surgeon, but the professor basically moved out of the surgeon seat, and it was a patient that had a tumor in his language area and his motor area. He had lost the ability to speak and lost the ability to move his right side. And I went under the microscope and took the tumor out, and the most gratifying thing was actually making rounds the next morning when he was able to speak and move his right side.
That quickly?
That quickly, within a matter of 24 hours. It was extremely gratifying.
You say that neurosurgeons typically have pretty sizable egos. Well, to be honest, I wouldn't want a surgeon with a weak ego operating on my brain.
You want surgeons to have a healthy ego. But what I try to point out in the book is that it's not a matter of you know, trying to be like Jack Horner and Chisel Plum, or trying to do the most amazing micro dissection within the brain. You have to realize that the patient that's on the table is someone's mother, and you have to treat that patient like your mother or your father or your sister. So it's a very thin line, it's a very thin envelope between transgressing outside of the envelope, where you can do harm to the patient by being a little bit too arrogant, and doing just enough.
Well, how many neurosurgeons are there nationwide, at least the neurosurgeons who are doing this sort of thing that you're doing?
Leonard, there are approximately 3,500 neurosurgeons that are board certified in the United States.
That's a small number.
That's a small number. The majority of neurosurgeons focus primarily on operating on the spine, and there is a smaller number that focus on intracranial, operating within the brain itself.
So there are specialties within the specialty?
There are specialties within the specialty. And we believe that better outcomes are actually achieved when a surgeon, for example, that specializes in spine surgery is doing spine surgery, just like there are better outcomes when you go to a surgeon that specializes in tumors doing a tumor operation. And I would point out, even within tumors, at our group, we specialize within the type of tumor. So for some type of tumors, we have one surgeon that just does that type of tumor.
So a neurosurgeon like you wouldn't operate on a brain trauma patient like Natasha Richardson?
If I was on call,
we
would know what to do for brain trauma. But I primarily focus now on brain tumors.
Well, you said that most neurosurgeons focus on the spine, not the brain. Is working on the spine less dangerous? Can you achieve the same sort of thing?
You can still have danger in working on the spine, but the nerves that are outside of the brain, what are called the peripheral nerves or the spinal nerves, are much more forgiving than the brain. So they are hardier, and you're less likely to cause a devastating injury.
But in all cases, nerves never right themselves. If you damage a nerve, that's it forever, isn't it?
Not necessarily. What we know is that nerves can recover, but there does become a point when you can injure a nerve to the point that it is irreversible, and that's a point that you don't want to get to.
I gather that even within the specialty, there are a lot of people who don't know everything that need to be known. You mentioned that if you were on call, you would have handled the case like Natasha Richardson's. But there was an article in today's New York Times about how few doctors in the field know how to deal with brain trauma.
Well, I think all neurosurgeons know how to deal with brain trauma. It's fundamental training for neurosurgeons. One of the problems that we have in this country is that we don't have enough neurosurgeons. As I said in the beginning, there are only about 3,500 neurosurgeons in the country, and they're more
and,
than...
And why is that? Because we've been told now that it's the hardest thing to find is a GP. Everybody wants to specialize in something, and neurosurgeons, I'm sure, make more money than an awful lot of other people in medicine.
I think what we try to do is that, we're trying to basically predict manpower needs, 10 years out. And it takes coming through the pipeline about 20 years to increase the number of neurosurgeons. And 20 years ago, we felt there were too many specialists, and we were trying to turn out more general practitioners. Now we realize that in order to cover our trauma needs in our healthcare system, we don't have enough specialized surgeons that can handle head trauma in the 10,000 hospitals that we have with only 3,500 brain surgeons.
And also, I gather, there's been an increase in brain cancer over the past few years.
Well, there are a number of studies, Leonard, that would certainly suggest that. Even when you correct for the aging population and better diagnostics with MRI scans, there are some studies to suggest that the incidence of brain tumors is on the rise. One of the things that we're very alarmed about is the fact that the second leading cause of cancer death in people less than 19 is now brain cancer.
And of those cancers, what percentage are usually operable?
Well, operable is a nebulous term, but about half of the tumors that we see are benign. And about half of the tumors are malignant. We can operate on most of those, but surgery alone is not always curative.
And there are cancers and cancers. A melanoma spread to the brain would be different than some other kind of cancer.
Right. So a lot of cancers will come from other areas of the body. We know that about 60% of patients with lung cancer at the time of death will have had spread of the tumors to the brain. About 30% of patients with breast cancer will spread to the brain.
Are they more operable, or is it the ones that are most operable, the ones that are just simply brain tumors?
The ones that come from other areas, once it goes to the brain, it presents a very unique set of problems. And one of those problems is that we cannot get drugs to tumors very well in the brain because of a barrier that's called the blood-brain barrier that doesn't allow chemotherapy to get into those areas.
We'll take a little break. We'll come back to that. My guest is Keith Black, who serves as chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery and director of the Maxine Dunitz Neurosurgical Institute at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. His book, Brain Surgeon, A Doctor's Inspiring Encounters with Mortality and Miracles, it is published by Grand Central. Stay with us for more. And you might want to tune in tomorrow when we'll be talking about the research into deep brain stimulation, which has been used to treat Parkinson's and depression, and why it's also sparked some controversy. And we invite you to check out the guest pick section on our website, where we ask some of our guests to reveal surprising facts about themselves. Did you know that Harold Varmus is a fan of ER, or that Linda Carter reads science journals for fun? Go to our show page at WNYC.org and click on Guest Picks. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by the New Jersey Symphony Orchestra with the premiere of Sergio Assad's new piece, written for and performed by the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, April 3rd and 4th at NJPAC in Newark, April 5th at Community Theater in Morristown. More at 1-800-ALL-EGRO or NJSymphony.org. Broadway Panhandler, a cook's best resource, and Regal Ware Cookware, hosting a knife sharpening event for City Harvest this weekend at 65 East 8th Street with a cooking demonstration by Chef Marcus Samuelson on Sunday at 2 p.m. More at BroadwayPanhandler.com.
New York City's own station, WNYC, in the city where more than 7 million people live in peace and enjoy the benefits of democracy.
WNYC, AM and FM.
American popular music has always been fascinated with the end of the world, whether natural disasters or nuclear war. Today on Soundcheck, how disaster and paranoia influence artists from John Coltrane to R.E.M. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. We're back with Keith Black, who's written a book called Brain Surgeon, A Doctor's Inspiring Encounters with Mortality and Miracles. It's published by Grand Central. You say that you had a love affair with science and medicine since you were a young boy. Your mother even gave you the hearts of chickens that she cleaned for you to dissect?
That's very true. When my mother was cooking a chicken, with the heart in the sink, I was fascinated with the heart and started dissecting the heart. And I always describe my parents as being the ultimate educators. And my father, who sort of recognized that, then went out and got me a turkey heart, which I dissected, and then went to the slaughterhouse and got me a cow heart and just cultivated my interest in science.
But you're not a cardiologist. What happened?
Well, it was interesting, Leonard. Early on, when I went into medical school, I thought I might go into cardiology, but then I picked up a book on neuroanatomy. And once I started reading about the brain, I became fascinated with the human brain. I think it was, for me, one of the most incredible structures that I had ever known about in the universe.
You were born in Alabama in the late 50s. You grew up at a time when George Wallace was the governor of the state. How did you wind up going to medical school?
I think the reason is good parenting. My parents, both being educators, recognized the importance of a good education. My brother, who was in the school system at the time, actually went away to a private school in New Hampshire. And when I was entering high school, my parents moved out of Alabama so that I could attend school in a better public school system in Cleveland.
And then you went to medical school, University of Michigan, but you say you experienced racism there as well.
Well, it was You know, racism in the North was different than racism in the South. Racism in the South at the time was more overt. It was more subtle in the North. I remember one episode where I put on my best suit and shirt and tie and went to the chairman of the department and indicated my interest in neurosurgery, and he was not very supportive of me going into neurosurgery. I think looking, you know, primarily at the color of my skin, you know, he did not believe that women, that African Americans, should go into neurosurgery at the time.
Well, that's changed, and so has an awful lot of the technology changed over the years, we'd hope, right?
That's right. And so I, you know, I just, you know, encountered situations like that and just used that as more of a inspiration to just work harder and to be more determined.
Some patients might say there's too much research available because doctors often disagree on the course of treatment, and a patient is sometimes left to decide. Is it fair to ask a patient to make those kinds of decisions?
I think that it's important to inform the patient. I think it's important to give the patient as much information as we can so that they can make an informed decision. When you're dealing with the tumor for, you know, like a brain tumor, which has a very limited survival, even with standard care, about 15 months for the most aggressive type, we know that one of the benefits for patients could be participating in clinical trials. Of only a very small percentage of patients participate in clinical trials. And
well, sometimes there's a placebo involved, and I know that if I had brain cancer and you told me that I might be taking something that will have absolutely no impact, I might try to find a different mode of treatment.
Right. So there are some trials that are, you know, placebo control. Usually those are the latter trials, usually late phase 2 or phase 3. Some of the earlier trials are not, and those patients all get therapeutics. One of the things that we've been investigating at our institution at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles is the development of a therapeutic vaccine to activate the body's immune system against a tumor. And in our phase 2 trials, what we found is that we can convert the 2-year survival of the most aggressive tumor from about 8% to 42% at 2 years. So it's showing some promise.
Vaccines fighting cancer seem to be more successful with certain kinds of cancers,
right,
than others. What about the brain tumor that Senator Edward Kennedy was diagnosed with? What is that called? A glioblastomas?
A glioblastoma.
A glio, okay. Is that the most common form of brain cancer?
It's one of the most common forms of tumors that originate in the brain that are cancerous. Unfortunately, it makes up about 60% of the aggressive tumors that start within the brain itself.
And what kind of prognosis would he have?
It's hard to say for an individual patient, but again, for a glioblastoma multiforme, we know that most patients' life expectancy is less than 2 years.
You describe sometimes in stomach-turning graphic detail the methods used to extract various brain tumors. Can you ever remove it entirely? Because we talked earlier about trying to avoid touching the healthy brain cells, and I'm assuming that if you get rid of the tumor in its entirety, you're going to be touching the neighboring cells.
For the benign tumors, a lot of those tumors we can cure.
They won't grow back?
Sometimes, yeah. For example, for a benign meningioma, 90% of those tumors would not grow back, or 95% would not grow back. For the malignant tumors, we know that there are microscopic cells that are hiding within areas of the brain that we cannot see, either under the microscope at surgery or on an MRI scan. So surgery for those tumors is not curative, and what we're working on is to try to find ways like the vaccine and other targeted drug therapies to kill those microscopic cells that are hiding within the brain.
We've talked quite a bit on this show about all the toxins in our environment, from pesticides to cleaning products and plastics. Do you believe that environmental factors are causing some of these brain tumors?
We know that there are environmental risk factors for brain cancer. We know that, for example, that people that work in plastic factories have a higher incidence of brain cancer because of the vinyl chloride exposure. Firemen have an occupational risk because of the diesel exhaust. They turn on the diesel engine of the fire truck, slide down the pole, and inhale that. So those things we know are environmental risk that can, contribute.
What about dental x-rays?
It's a worry. We know that x-ray exposure can lead to brain tumors. One of the treatments for a tinea, ringworm on the head, years ago used to be x-rays, and those patients develop meningiomas, a benign tumor, and other things. One of the things I talk about in the book, for example, is the potential overuse of dental x-rays, because those x-rays will scatter into the brain, and that may be a risk as well.
And many people are concerned about cell phone use. Do you consider that to be a danger?
We know that the answer on cell phones is still out. There have been some studies that have been published to show no correlation with cell phones and brain cancer, but other studies have shown a correlation, and particularly studies that have looked at exposure of cell phones for over 10 years that have shown a over 2.5-fold increase in brain cancer. You know, what I say is that it is very much like someone smoking a cigarette. If you start smoking a cigarette at 14, you don't expect to develop lung cancer at 24. You expect to develop lung cancer at 44. A lot of environmental toxins take 30 years in order to have an effect. So we don't yet have 30-year studies looking at the exposure of cell phones. And I just advise my patients and friends to be cautious, to have the information, and use an earpiece whenever possible to avoid the exposure.
Is that what you do?
Yes.
We have really not gone into chemotherapy, but there's always been that problem about the about that brain
blood-brain barrier.
Are they developing new chemotherapy approaches?
Most of the research has been focused on developing drugs that can target the tumor cell.
And vaccines. You mentioned the dendrite vaccines.
Right, the dendritic cell-based vaccines. But the blood-brain barrier will still be a problem because most of the drugs that we develop cannot get across the barrier. A lot of our research has been focused on trying to find ways to selectively open that barrier. Interestingly, one of the recent drugs that we found that's very good at opening the barrier, it's a drug for erectile dysfunction, Viagra and Levitra, because of its activation of phosphodiesterase 5. And at least in our laboratory models, we can dramatically increase chemotherapy and brain tumors using those drugs.
So you give somebody Viagra and then you go after the brain tumor? I mean, this is one of those things where Viagra was discovered in an attempt to come up with to solve a very different kind of problem.
Right.
It winds up making billions of dollars because of something that nobody even realized was possible. And now you're saying it can be used in fighting brain cancer?
Potentially. We have worked for almost 20 years looking at the biochemical pathways to get drugs across the barrier, and it turns out that this is one of the drugs that's already FDA approved that intersects in that pathway, that if we give those drugs with chemotherapy, we could improve delivery of those drugs directly to the brain tumor.
But does that mean that if you use erectile dysfunction drugs, you're at risk of having other things cross the blood-brain barrier?
The amazing thing, Leonard, is that it doesn't open the normal barrier. It only opens the barrier in areas of disease. So it probably will not adversely affect normal brain areas.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. I've been talking with Keith Black, who serves as chairman of the Department of Neurosurgery and director of the Maxine Dennitz Neurosurgical Institute at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. His book is called Brain Surgeon, A Doctor's Inspiring Encounters with Mortality and Miracles, and it's written with the help of Arnold Mann. And I should point out that there are some, as they say sometimes, there are some passages that might disturb children if they are reading this book, but it's a fascinating book. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.